It's live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. Good morning. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100. That's 509-826-0100. Senator Short, let's start with you. It was a weekend of taxes for this Easter weekend in Olympia. On Saturday, several tax bills passed out of the Senate.
There were. We were on the floor for nearly 8 hours debating these bills. But the one that took the most time that I wanted to focus on, they're all bad, by the way, is the sales tax increase on certain services. And when you think about that, and they talk about regressivity all the time, the Democrats do, and how they don't want, you know, we're such a regressive state when it comes to taxes. All of these bills are regressive. These bills are going to be, you know, the costs, the increases are going to be, you know, passed along to consumers and to Washingtonians. You know, they tax computing services, IT, temporary staffing. So if you're, you know, a business that, you know, that hire temporary staff, you're going to be hit. Security services, synthetic nicotine products. But the biggest one is something that many years ago the state of Washington did, and it's called the 25th month. But what it really does is this would require businesses to pay basically their 30 days worth of sales taxes, considered like new fiscal year July, and pay them in June to balance the budget. The thing is it takes years and years to catch that up, and is such a bad idea, such an incredibly bad idea. And during the debate, Senate Republicans on the ninth order, so that's a parliamentary motion where we can force a vote on a bill that we bring to the floor, we brought our budget forward, Senate Bill 5810, and just said, look, here's a template. Here's a template that we can balance the budget, you know, employ important services that the state of Washington, you know, these are, you know, foundational things the state should do. We give raises to state employees, albeit not their contract, but we still recognize their important work they do to the state of Washington without furloughs. And we do it without raising taxes. And you should have heard the Democrats talk about the bill. Oh, it was just stunning to me. I mean, they're on this path that says, well, we want to build the kind of budget we want to build and forget the impact to Washingtonians. It was a stunning day, a very somber day. Was proud of the fight that we led and gave on these bills. But it was just really bad.
Well, they may run into a wall too. The wall is Governor Ferguson, who keeps on indicating that he's not going to sign a budget with all these new taxes. He even indicated over the weekend that there's a pretty good chance there will be a special session to deal with this.
Well, and there could, it's just, we're all curious, frankly, and hopeful that he will be a little bit more sane than his Democratic colleagues when it comes to a sustainable budget. But look, folks, the taxes all told over 4 years, including local taxation, they actually increased the ability of schools to do more local taxation for property taxes for education, when really that's the state's paramount duty to fund education. It would be to the tune of $18.4 billion. That is so much money. My brain doesn't even compute that, except to know that that's going to be so incredibly draconian to families, to individuals, to small businesses, really to just our state's economy. So I am hopeful that he will choose a different path, and we'll see if it lands us in special session or not.
So you have that to look forward to, Representatives Engel and Abell. Those bills are headed to the House now. But there are a couple in the House as well that also raise taxes. Since you're on finance, Representative Abell, why don't you tell us about those?
Yeah, sure. So we were working early and late on Saturday in the Finance Committee. We met bright and early, and we had such an array of tax increases in front of us that we didn't get done in time, and they had to hold the floor session for the Finance Committee to keep reviewing and voting on these proposed tax increases. It's a bunch of bad ones. A proposed increase in the property tax from the 1% levy limit up to 3%. Proposed increase in B&O taxes that are going to hit some of our most successful businesses in this state, the ones that provide a lot of the business, a lot of the jobs. And just a series of tax proposals. Now, Republicans offered a wide variety of amendments on these to try and make them less painful and, of course, voted against them in the end. But they marched them through the Finance Committee. They will be set for action on the floor here in the near future. But the other side has planted their flag on dramatically raising taxes on pretty much everything that we do here in the state of Washington as an effort to address the budget deficit rather than engaging what I think would be the much more healthy exercise of finding efficiencies within our state budget. As you and I have talked about before, our state budget has doubled in size right. in the last 15 years. And in my time being here, I'm starting to see why,
yeah.
what the right, other side right, wants right. to spend their money on. So, disappointing day on Saturday, day before Easter, but that's what we've got going on in the Finance Committee.
So, to recap, sales taxes in the Senate, property and B&O taxes in the House. I'm not an expert on taxes, but those sound like they're regressive to me. That doesn't sound like progressive revenue that the Democrats have been talking about.
Yeah, extremely regressive. There's another one out there, the proposed increase in the gas tax, which again, given our huge district size, it's going to hit those of us who live in rural areas much harder than those who live in urban and suburban areas. And a big part of what we try and do in Olympia is just trying to educate the majority about how our district is very different than a Seattle-based district or even Spokane or Tacoma. Sometimes we'll be able to make some progress there, but on these tax issues, just not making it through. And the other side, again, has, as I said, planted their flag. That's what they're committed to doing is raising taxes just across the board.
There's even a special tax just for Tesla. Did that get out of the House?
It did,
I mean, it literally just taxes Tesla.
Yeah, the Musk tax. Yeah, frankly, I'll say it seemed almost like a gleeful vote on the other side on that one. It was worrisome for me, seeing that dynamic. A tax on essentially Tesla another example of the Democrats reaching for pretty much anything that they can tax and pushing that button repeatedly.
Well, this is an interesting one, too, because Tesla, the reason they're getting taxed is because they've been so successful in selling so many electric cars, electric vehicles here in Washington. In this, it's funny how things have changed because it used to be that that's what the Democrats were really wanted to have happen.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it shows that, government plays, picks winners and losers. And not that long ago, Tesla was a winner from the ruling party here in Olympia. And now because of a changed perception about the owner, it's now a loser. And now, they want to stick a pretty significant tax on effectively just Teslas. And so, disappointing morning. As I said, I thought it was interesting. It was a bit of a tail wagging the dog there because usually floor session dominates committee schedules. Mm-hmm. But these tax increases are so important that they held floor session so that Finance Committee can continue voting out these proposed tax increases. So I thought that was an interesting dynamic.
Representative Engel, when you finally did get on the floor, what were some of the things that came up on Saturday?
Well, we had a number of things from raising the realtor license fees, a new law on how truancy is dealt with children who are not going to school. That was a pretty controversial bill. We had this bill came back to mandate diaper changing stations in public buildings, paid family medical leave expansion. One of the things I think was really particularly frustrating for me was a bill called K-12 Savings and Efficiencies. And I'll just say, I think we really need a bunch of education savings and efficiencies. That sounds great. Problem is the bill didn't do that. The bill did two things. First, it played this game where it takes a small percentage, maybe 2 or 3% each of the next several months until August, and doesn't pay it to schools. And instead, it pays it to them in September, so it moves into the next fiscal year. So it's just playing a game to make it look like they saved money. But it, of course, it's going to impact a lot of our schools that will have less money to work with in the short term, and they got to deal with that. The other thing the bill does is to impact schools that have a high population. Over 33% of their students are online. It's through the what's called an ALE, Alternative Learning Experiences. And, you know, I think they made the speech, they said something like, this only affects a dozen schools. Well, four of them are in the 7th District that I know of, OMAC, Republic, Kettle Falls, and Valley. And what this does is if you have more than 33% of your students enrolled in this program, it gives you a 33% cut to your levy effort assistance dollars, which for this school of Valley, that's a $300,000 a year cut. Their local levy only brings in $150,000. So it's a really big issue. And they've been doing this program for 20 years. I made the speech on the floor in which I said, you know, we need to address costs and efficiencies. This bill doesn't do that. If we need to look at changing the program around ALE and LEA, we should have those discussions with the schools that will be impacted and, you know, start over. They, of course, they didn't take that advice. They passed it off. So that's really concerning with how it'll impact some of our schools, and it's a missed opportunity to actually address efficiencies. We had a number of amendments to try to actually make schools more efficient and save money. One particular amendment that was interesting was regarding capping how many dollars can be paid to a school superintendent to $250,000. And at first, I was a little unsure, like, what are we doing here? Well, it turns out there's a lot of schools in Washington State that pay far more than $250,000, some more than $400,000. Representative Abel gave a great speech about comparing. These are public servants. Keep in mind, these are not CEOs. These are school superintendents paid by the state of Washington, and they're public employees. The superintendent of public instruction makes less than $250,000. And so does a bunch of people from military. Representative Abel, did you want to hit that?
Yeah, I will say I was pretty shocked at this list of salaries and the amounts that we're talking about. A tremendous number of superintendents earning 300 some thousand, some earning at least one earning over $500,000. And to reiterate Andrew's point, these are public employees. These are not CEOs. And a dramatic increase in superintendent salaries over the course of the last decade. So I tried to compare a little bit apples to apples here of looking at other public sector employees, public service type jobs. So I looked at the U.S. military, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chief advisor to the U.S. president, all military matters would be in the bottom half of Washington State superintendents. Same with the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, responsible for all aspects of the nuclear triad, all components of World War III, bottom half of our state superintendents. Same with the commander of what we call U.S. Indo-PACOM, the Pacific Command, responsible for 52% of the world's Earth surface area and over half the world's population. Asserting U.S. national defense interests in that area would be less than half of our state superintendents. So something that's wildly out of whack with state superintendent.
Governor makes $234,000. So, you know, he's making less than a lot of superintendents. Yep. You mentioned... I don't know. How much does the president make? I mean, I think
400,000. We've got superintendents earning more than the president of the United States. I mean, really outrageous. It made me angry. I was generally aware that school administrator salaries had increased significantly over the course of the last 10 years, was not aware that it was to this extent. It's really out of all sense of proportion.
And that amendment failed?
That amendment failed, yeah.
I will say it was fun to watch Hunter give this speech because he's usually pretty diplomatic and calm, and he got kind of worked up, especially when he got gaveled in the middle of it for inappropriately. Actually, the speaker came and apologized to him afterwards. But
I was unjustly gaveled and got fired up,
got
even
gaveled?
More so.
Was
I
that
did.
The first time you've ever been gaveled?
No, I was.
You've been gaveled several times?
No, this is time number two. I got gaveled the first time on a life bill. And, you know, I... I can wear that one with pride. This one was unjust. And the speaker in his defense came up after and said, I'm sorry, I'm on no sleep and I hear a trigger. I shouldn't have gaveled yet. So
for people who don't know what gaveling means, it means that there are certain rules and there's a certain decorum in the House and Senate. If you break those rules, the speaker in the House and the president in the Senate will hit the gavel, right? And then say what you did wrong. But
conversely, I have stood up and objected when the other side has been, it's been demeaning and coercive, discussion. So both as floor leaders, both Senator Richelli and I have both stood up and objected. And then, of course, the president of the Senate, Lieutenant Governor, has to weigh in and decide what his decision on. But oftentimes you highlight it, and that's enough to kind of get things back under. Reel it in a little bit.
I'm glad on this particular one that Hunter was able to just move on with his speech, because sometimes they'll put the House at ease, and then it's a whole 5 minutes they're trying to discuss what they're going to do about it, and then you go back to the middle of your speech and finish your speech, and it really disrupts the flow. This one was kind of, it honestly gave it emphasis, false bad gavel, and then Hunter gets fired up a little more and finishes his speech with even more power than it would have been otherwise. I also wanted to go back to one thing. Senator Short talked about the tax increases that went through the Senate, and this one particularly around sales tax on services and software programs. I talked to the CEO of she was acting CEO of the OMAC Hospital the other day, and they were just talking about how big this will impact them. And, the hospital is running on less than a 1% margin, and so they have about $750,000 a month that they spend on contract labor. So this is doctors and nurses who are traveling in, filling in. They're essentially like your other employees, but under this bill, they'll be required to be paying sales tax, 8.5% on all of that labor. So that's very concerning. And then also they run millions of dollars to comply with the electronic health records. That's going to have to be paying sales tax on that as well. So just the sales tax proposal alone could put them in the wrong side of the profitability margin and jeopardize our healthcare.
Well, and the amounts that we were looking at on the sales tax bill, it would generate revenue of nearly $5 billion, the sales tax alone. And then on top of that, the authority for up to nearly $3 billion on the local side. So it's just, folks, it is just so unreal. It's not necessary. Again, we've shown that it's not necessary. But this has a real impact. These numbers have real impact.
Yeah, and really, I think one point that was made on the Senate floor time and time again is that most of these are going to be passed on to consumers, right, Cinder?
100%.
I mean, businesses just generally don't eat this stuff. They maybe use some of it, but at least some of it's going to be passed on to consumers.
Well, and think I just want to reiterate, prepaying your sales tax. That's not just, Democrats make it seem like, oh, that's just a day. That's July 1. No, it's the entire month. So businesses will be forced to pay a month sales tax that they haven't even earned on services they've provided. And they're going to have to remit that to the state of Washington. So you think about it, think about the revenue, is coming in to that last biennium, which is by June 30th, right? And it's revenue they don't have for the new biennium. And that's what takes years and years to catch that back up. They did that back when we were in the recession in the early 2000s. And I think it took something like, it was some insane, like 12 years or something to catch that up. I mean, folks, it's just, again, I go back to the business pay B&O. That's on gross receipts. That's not a net tax. And now you're going to add this extra sales tax, on top of it. And it's really stunning. It's just stunning not necessary.
And really to drive home something we've talked about before, both people and businesses in Washington are increasingly mobile compared to what they were, a generation or a couple of generations ago. And, we have folks who have resources and the ability to move, who will just up and move as a result of these taxing decisions. And that's really problematic. One thing that struck me about this array of tax proposals is the increase on the property tax. And that will hit our individuals with limited incomes, our retirees, the hardest. But also, all session long, we've been talking about our housing crisis.
Right.
And then we decide to go and jack up the taxes on property. And so it seems like there's a tremendous disconnect there. But Tracy, I think I've told you before, you know, I've got a neighbor up in Inchilliam. He and his family have been there as long as I can remember. They're moving to Lewiston. Mm. They're done. And it's extremely sad. But they're not alone. And so I have worries they're going to see a similar, you know, it was a trickle and maybe now a flood of people heading out of Washington because of this.
Well, I'll say that could help address our housing crisis, but in the wrong way. We don't want to address our housing crisis by driving our best people out of the state.
Right.
Right. You know, again, with this property tax, we should emphasize when we have someone here who owns rental properties, that this also affects rents. I mean, sometimes people, again, think that property tax only affects people who the only homeowners, but if you own a rental property, you know, it's the same thing that we were talking about with some of these other taxes that gets passed along to the renter oftentimes, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it's one thing that's frustrating to me. I've seen lots of legislators talk in their speeches and in their even discussions with this disconnect. They don't seem to understand that taxes on businesses relate to the consumer. I know we had the bill, I think it was last week, about extended producer responsibilities. This is essentially a huge tax on groceries, anything that's packaged. But it's paid by the manufacturer. And a lot of the Democrats who are pushing this seem to think that it's not going to cost the people anymore. No, the employers are just going to pay this cost and they're not going to pass it on. But that's just not how business works. And it's not how it works with landlords. All these operations are operating in a way where it's supply and demand, but also it's costs and benefits. And if you get an increase in your costs, you have to raise your prices. That's just how it works.
Well, you know, there's going to be obviously a lot more. It's crazy because there's still a lot of unanswered questions, a ton of unanswered questions, and we have less than a week in this legislative session. So, I mean, Senator Short, how does that work? You've been here the longest by far. What's going to happen this week, and eventually, how does this all get resolved?
Well, there's a flurry of hurry up and wait, first of all, because this is the time in session where we have two phrases we use: necessary to implement the budget, bills that need to be passed, and necessary to pass the budget, which is a much different thing. As they're negotiating budgets, the bills that are going to come up this week are really going to be tied to the budget. Now, we are finishing up some work on, you know, opposite House bills, you know, how our bills were changed in the House and how the House's bills were changed in the Senate. And that's called a concurrence process, whether you agree or disagree with the changes to particular bills. We'll continue through that process as well. But I need to share some really somber news. Saturday evening, one of our colleagues in the Senate passed away unexpectedly. Senator Bill Ramos, he serves in the 5th Legislative District, which encompasses Issaquah, North Bend, part of King County. And, you know, you just saw them. You just spent the day together, right, on the floor. And, you know, our prayers go out to his family. Look, we argue a lot on the floor, but we're still human beings. We still care, you know, for each other. And it's just going to be a tremendously sad day on the Senate today, on the Senate floor.
That is sad. Also sad news this morning, for people who haven't heard, Pope Francis passed away this morning.
He did. One thing I'd like to add too, and these, because other things do come up, from time to time we'll still have committee hearings, and we will be having one of those hopefully this Wednesday, and that's hearings on the confirmation process of the Fish and Wildlife Commissioners, the new ones that the governor appointed. We were really nervous as to whether or not we were going to get the paperwork in time, but we'd like to start that process. I don't know if they'll come before the full Senate to actually have that formal confirmation, but we want to do our part in committee and have the hearings on those individuals as well as a vote. So I believe Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. we'll be having hearings on those individuals who were selected by the governor.
This is a pretty big deal. People may not realize that this commission has a lot of influence, and there's been a lot of controversy surrounding the Fish and Wildlife Commission, hasn't there?
Oh, yes, there has. The tone and tenor of the commission under Inslee's last couple of years really went incredibly away from what I believe is still very much the foundation of fish and wildlife, which, yes, we want to preserve species and that, but it's also important to manage them. It's important to support the hunting and fishing and just really management of these species. And we have seen it in recent years go drastically away from that. So I'm excited that the governor, I mean, that was the first thing that landed on his lap at the beginning of session was whether or not he was going to accept those appointments. And I'm really grateful that he didn't. He took a couple of months, you know, to go through interviews of, I believe it was 15 individuals who had sought an appointment. And I think he landed in a really good place. So hopefully that's going to bring some more balance. I feel like the 7th Legislative District rises and falls by, or ebbs and flows, if you will, with the commission decisions, and they have tremendous influence on that process. So I'm excited to hopefully be able to see a different tone and tenor with the decisions that are being made.
Yeah. In the 7th, you get wolves and bears and
cougars.
Oh my.
Yeah, oh my. Yeah.
Indeed. When we come back, I might get your general thoughts of the session thus far. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the other controversial bills, too, that still haven't been voted off the floor of each chamber. It's live from Olympia. If you have a question, feel free to email me, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. Back with Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter Abel on Okanagan Country Radio after this. And welcome back to Live from Olympia with Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell and Senator Shelley Short. I'm Tracy Ellis from the Washington State Republican Caucus and Washington State Senate Republican Caucus, that is. And if you have a question, I do encourage you to email me at tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov, tracy.ellis@legwa.gov, or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. A couple of bills that one passed the Senate and is in the House, one passed the House and is coming back to the Senate. Let's start with rent control, which passed out of the Senate. Now, the original proposal was for a 7% cap on rent increases a year. So landlords could only increase rents by 7% a year. Some Democrats used up a lot of political capital and voted with Republicans to change that to 10% a year plus inflation, which is a huge deal. Representative Engel could talk more about why that's a big deal coming up. But now the bill is back in the House. It started in the House. It's back in the House. And what do you think, representatives? Do you think that the House is going to stick with that 10% plus inflation, or do you think there'll be another change?
I think it's a great question. We're waiting to find out. It's one of these things that, I mean, honestly, we kind of hope that the fight will be between the House and the Senate Democrats at this point on this bill, and perhaps they'll run out of time to pass the bill at all this year, which would be fantastic. I think it'd be good if Senator Short talked a little bit about what the changes made in the Senate were. It did make a substantially less bad. It's still a pretty bad bill. But having this 10% plus inflation really probably will reduce the chances of landlords just automatically taking this every year. But it's still concerning.
Well, one of the additional things we got, which and proffered a lot of debate on the floor, was actually exempting single family homes. So if you were just, you know, just say a person owning a piece of property, you would be exempt from that cap. Now, obviously, they cut it off if you were part of a corporation or an LLC or something like that, then you didn't get that benefit. But that was a hugely debated thing. When you think about a lot of moms and pops owning a home that they've had, you know, extra property and they use that for retirement and all of that, those single family residences would not be, you know, they would be excluded from the bill essentially. Man, I can tell you what, whew, it got Western on the floor. from the Democrat side, and really what it really was when we passed those amendments, you know, by the way, it takes at a minimum 6 Democratic senators to join with us. Not a small task. What I think it really showed is how out of touch their own caucus was with their members. And that's not a gleeful thing. That's just a like, hey, I mean, we have a variety of members in all of our caucuses. And to be on a path where you either aren't, you know, shut down, you know, the ability to have those conversations in your caucus, it's like, how would you not know? How would you not know that there was, you know, 6 to 8 people, depending, in your caucus of 30 individuals to not say that they were concerned, you know, and it really played out on the floor. And we did pass it with that single family exemption and that 10% plus inflation. So it's going to be interesting to see what the House does.
You know, it's interesting because that amendment to up at the 10% plus inflation came from an economics professor at Western Washington University who's, you know, some would describe her as a pretty progressive Democrat, but she understands economics, right? A 7% cap without inflation, again, representative Engel, I mean, you own apartment rentals. I mean, that's difficult because you can't even say there's inflation. You can't even make up for that. Right. Under that 7%. So that's why I said that this is significant, right?
It is significant. Well, and the other thing is that housing costs rise and they don't necessarily mirror inflation, especially in the 7th District where we've got a lot of insurance issues where insurance companies are sometimes given 40, 50% increases in insurance. Taxes are going up faster. So there's a lot of costs that sometimes need to be recouped. Other things is, you can have units that all of a sudden have something major go wrong and you could spend tens of thousands of dollars fixing it up. And all of a sudden your unit that you were willing to rent out significantly below market to help someone out for a while, you can't justify doing that anymore. You're not going to be able to make your payments.
Even with all of that, Representative Engel has said before the show, he rarely raises rents on people. So, you know, I mean, that's the other thing. If people like you get out of the business because of the stuff like this, I mean, that could be troublesome also, right? I mean,
that's a major concern. And it's not just a concern. It's a reality. We see it every year. I talk to landlords who, you know, the small landlords who have relationships with their tenants, that's what we want more of because it helps break down those socioeconomic relationship barriers. As you get to know people in different income classes than yourselves, you can work with people because there's a relationship there. And every year, more regulations come along and a handful, and some of those people leave. They sell. What often happens is they sell it to, if it's a single family home, they're selling it to someone from often Seattle, comes in, displaces the tenant. Now there's one less local person has a place to live. Or if it's an apartment, they sell it. And often it goes to, you know, out of state owners or corporate ownership, and they will often just evict all the tenants, renovate, dramatically increase the rent, and repopulate it. So these policies absolutely increase our homelessness. I've seen it over and over again.
Well, and something also that kind of pertains to what Andrew was just talking about is that these small landlords who own properties and are renting them in our communities are directly investing in the communities. They're providing a service that's tremendously important. They have close contact and connections with their renters. Their renters' kids are going to the same schools as the landlord's kids, or they're going to the same church or running into them at Walmart or Safeway or whatever it might be. That's really important. That's exactly what we want more of and not less of, and that's one of the dangers of this bill is it's going to drive small landlords out of business.
You feel like sometimes that And maybe it's a different situation in places like Seattle, but do you ever feel like the Democrats, they look at landlords all as kind of, like, I don't know, Senator Short, can you help me out here? I mean, do they look at them as sometimes, if it feels like just hearing some of their floor speeches, they look at all landlords as being bad maybe, you know?
Well, they do. They really do. And it's not just the landlord issue. It's, you know, our land use policies. I mean, we know for a fact, economics has shown us when you build more, when you have more supply available, that brings down the cost, the overall cost of homes, you know, on some general basis, right? And we continue to stifle the growth and development. And so the prices have not, there's been, the pressure on prices has been immense. And so you add this on top of it. And of course, it's really easy to look at the, you know, big bad landowner or landlord, excuse me. You know, but instead of looking at the systemic issues and the reason we're here, you know, there's no ladder, what I call, you know, ladder homes anymore. I mean, if you couldn't buy a home, you might be able to rent. Rent was generally less expensive, or, you know, there were those smaller homes available and those generally were less costly to purchase. And I mean, all of that's just been blown out of the water. And we continue to pass these policies, you know, whether it's the land use policies or whether it's, you know, building codes and things. It's like I always talk about what's a necessary health and safety code versus a want to. What's the need to versus the want to? And I'm sure I'm going to get my earful of that being a member now on the Building Code Council. But those things unilaterally continue to drive cost. And it's so incredibly frustrating. And yet the policies that we see this year are going to continue to make it worse.
Can you try to get them to change the rule that makes the lights turn off when you don't move enough? that happens in this room all the time. Anyway.
I think one interesting bill we had, I believe was last week, was around housing, was a tax exemption for accessory dwelling units. So this is, people would build a small home on their property, they'll rent it out, or it's a mother-in-law unit. And this bill allowed people who have accessory dwelling units and they rent it out at an affordable rate to get a property tax exemption for that ADU. Sounds like a kind of a logical thing, but the problem is it only applied if the ADU was in Pierce County. And they already had did this a year or two ago to allow this in King County, so Pierce County wanted to allow it. I got up and spoke on the floor about it and said, you know, if people want to build a small house on their property and allow a low-income person to live next to them, good for them. And they should be incentivized, and this could be something that could be useful, a tool. However, when you only apply it to the two richest counties in the state, it actually produces a small tax shift, probably not one we're going to notice, but in principle, this is the rest of the state subsidizing the two richest counties in the state. In principle, it's a terrible bill, and I voted no.
Would you have voted for it if it applied to the entire state?
I probably would have. I would have liked to have talked to some of my county tax assessors because it could be a little bit complicated to administer. Mm-hmm. But I do think that in principle, it makes sense that you incentivize things like that because that really could help address our housing issues. If you could get several hundred dollars a year tax exemption in exchange for renting it at an affordable rate up next to your house, I think there's some good side rails there and it could have been an effective policy.
Got a question here from Janine. She says, does the public get a chance to vote on these bills? I think she's probably talking about the tax bills. Or is that just going through the Senate, she said, but it'd be the House and the Senate, obviously. So go ahead.
Yeah, great question, Janine. Thank you for asking that. So the short answer is no. The way these bills have been presented, and at least is how they've been advanced so far, is that they would take effect without a vote of the people. Now, with every tax proposed increase that we've seen in the Finance Committee, we have offered amendments to say that these tax increases can only take effect upon a vote of the people in the local jurisdiction. And the Democrats have declined that time after time after time. They usually do some throat clearing and they say, well, you know, of course we trust the people. But in effect, not that much. They sent us here to make that decision. We don't want to, you know, bother the people, the good citizens of the state of Washington with voting on this. So unfortunately, Janine, the answer is no. That's extremely disappointing, I think, for a lot of the people who have been working on these tax issues.
Sometimes they'll take it a step further. They'll say exactly what Hunter's saying, but sometimes I've heard them say, the people trust us and want us to make these decisions for them. They don't want to be tasked with mm-hmm. making these decisions, which I disagree.
Oh, 100%. I think our email, the flow of our email would suggest there's people feel differently. Janine, we had the same thing, unfortunately, in the Senate, on the tax bills or any legislation, just not wanting it to go to a vote of the people, allowing a referendum. And the frustrating thing with the tax bills is those tax bills. So we have a 105-day session and the tax bills were introduced and heard the same day on Wednesday last week, like 4 days ago, and then hurriedly passed out of the budget committee, our Ways and Means Committee, on Friday. And then we spent all day on Saturday on the floor debating those. And we have talked about, just not allow, it doesn't allow anybody any time to get their head around what the true cost and the enormity of these policies are. And I think it's just such a bad precedent. Frankly, it shows that those in the majority here in the legislature, the majority Democrats, they don't want you to participate. They don't want to have to be held accountable. They think they're in districts where they aren't held accountable for making those kinds of decisions. And folks, we've got a job to do to show them otherwise. But it's been incredibly frustrating. To me, the best bills that come out of here are bills that are incredibly scrutinized. They may even take several sessions to even come to fruition, but it's had people looking at it, and we've had comment and testimony and people looking at it wanting changes. And that to me is where you see the successful We the People process. And frankly, and if it isn't something you want, then we shouldn't be afraid to let people vote on it.
A bill that passed the Senate, went to the House, got changed, and is coming back to the Senate. Yes, I believe this is right. Representative Abel does this thing with his finger when he starts going back and forth when I start doing this. But anyway, it's the unemployment insurance bill, the bill that grants striking workers unemployment benefits. So that got changed in the House from what happened in the Senate. Now it's coming back to the Senate. Maybe you could explain where that bill is and what you hope happens next with it.
Well, the House, first of all, the bill originated in the Senate, and the original version of the bill had 12 weeks of unemployment available for striking workers. We knew that absolutely was unsustainable from an unemployment standpoint, from employers paying into the unemployment insurance system and really, really giving a carrot, if you will, to folks, kind of an incentive to strike, right? But the House amazingly had an amendment that changed the 12 weeks to 4 weeks. We tried doing that in the Senate. We weren't successful. We lost that by one vote. But the House was able to do that. So our job right now is to work like we can, like just work really hard to sustain that. Look, the bill still isn't acceptable, but at least having it 4 weeks versus 12 weeks is really important. We know there's tremendous pressure to change that back. Hopefully we can hold it at the four. But if we can't, maybe the bill dies under its own weight, which wouldn't be a bad thing either. So stay tuned. There's lots of conversations on this bill.
And if I can just weigh in for a moment on the weird dynamics created by this bill, and this is probably common sense for anyone who's thought about this for a moment, but the very nature of a strike is that by going on strike, the pain and the disruption that's caused by that for both employment or for management and the rank and file, the labor side, ends up hopefully bringing about a resolution of the dispute sooner rather than later. But by creating this unemployment insurance for striking workers, you create these perverse incentives that's just going to prolong the labor dispute. you know, for whatever period of time.
I heard one senator say that if it's a 12 weeks unemployment guarantees a 12-week strike, right?
Right, exactly. No, that's exactly it. And that's the head scratcher with a big part of this bill is that this is not going to bring about a faster resolution of labor disputes. It's just going to exacerbate labor disputes, you know, in a time when, frankly, our economy is, struggling on a variety of fronts. And so this is a problematic bill. And I think the more people look into it, the more realization there is that there's a lot of problems.
But one thing that happens in the legislature is if you look at it as a bit like Republicans don't have a lot of say in what happens with these bills because they're in the minority, but you can sometimes help to make a bad bill better, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the case here with, you know, Republicans obviously voted for the amendment, I would imagine, that changed it from 12 weeks to 4 weeks. So, you know, that's one way to maybe actually have some impact from the minority.
Mm-hmm. No, that's correct. I mean, you know, a big part of being the minority is being the opposition, holding the majority's feet to the fire and pointing out, you know, areas where we think their bills are bad or where they could be improved. Also, part of one of our jobs is to show the people how we would govern if we were in the majority. And the Senate Republicans did a great job passing out a budget, or rather putting forward a budget this year that would have addressed our budget deficit without raising taxes. That's just an important model to show the people of Washington how we would govern if we were the majority. But it's our job to ask those tough questions, and we've been asking them all session long.
Overall, speaking of all session long, what are your overall views of the session? You're both freshman representatives. This is brand new to you. So it'll be interesting to hear how you characterize the session compared to Senator Short, who's been around for a few of them.
Well, obviously, it's my first one, so I don't have anything to compare it to. I have found it very fascinating. I liken it to when I was in the fire department and you go to a house that's burning down or a catastrophic car accident. And I would say it's terrible that this is happening. But as long as it's happening, I'm enjoying being part of the battle to keep it from being worse than it is.
Right.
And I think it's kind of like that here. I feel like I fit in well here. I feel like I'm able to make some beneficial work here with relationship and having conversations with people of various persuasions. And so it's, just really terrible, the amount of bad ideas. I think they're bad ideas that are coming forward, how fast things move. You know, we've voted on like 350 bills off the floor so far. And, you know, the majority of those are actually good bills. They're necessary to streamline government, make sure things are operational, they're bipartisan. And then about the other half are a mix where a lot of them are going to be devastating, or they're just stupid. Honestly, sometimes I'm a little blunt. Some of these bills are just stupid.
You would get gaveled down for using that word.
There's a bill the other day we had about creating a fee to fish in the Columbia River or its tributaries.
Brought Isn't to us everywhere.
Well, so it's. You know, hunting, fishing licenses, this would add a special if you want to fish for salmon or sturgeon in the Columbia River or its tributaries, you'd have to pay a $7.50 fee in order to fish for those things, but only if you are in the Columbia River or the tributaries of the Columbia River, which is mostly eastern Washington. Ironically, this bill was brought to us by a member from Vashon Island, a member from Federal Way, and a member from Seattle. So those three members, but people who fish for salmon and sturgeon in those areas will not have to pay this fee, and they don't have to, and they, you know, so they save money. This was pretty offensive to me. I spoke on it and I really wanted to point this out, but that would have got gaveled, right? That's considered impugning. But it is offensive when people from one area want to write legislation about a different people that they don't understand.
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating. So I've seen a lot of that here, and that's frustrating. I want to have more time to have conversations with people about these things. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to us?
Yeah.
You know, if you feel like it's ironically, there is one district along the Columbia River that's Democrat and near Vancouver. Both of them are very liberal, but they both voted against that bill.
Yeah. Speaking of time, we're starting to run out, but Representative Abel, we have a few minutes left.
I guess I have a slightly different analogy. I think of it as kind of similar to an 8-man football game.
Okay.
Which you probably have 8-man football on there.
If you've ever watched 8-man football, there's a lot of scoring.
A lot of scoring. My coach in Inchalim used to call it a track meet and pads.
Yeah.
So a lot of running, a lot of scoring. Part of doing 8-man football is you learn how to take a hit and how to go out and put a hit on someone, you know, and get back up. And we played Ironman football in Inchalim. game where the eight guys on offense were also the eight guys on defense. So our teams were pretty small. So I think there's some life lessons there. I feel like we've done some good plays this session. We've gone, made, you know, some touchdowns. The other side has, you know, more people. They've got the majority. And so we were aware of that coming in. But it's been fast paced. It's been exciting. And, you know, just like with a football game, you know, we're now down into about the last minute. And so, you know, we'll see what ends up happening if we end up going into a special session. But I think there's a lot of comparisons with eight-man football in a session here in Olympia.
Having called some eight-man football as a broadcaster, I can tell you, the last minute, a lot of stuff can happen.
A lot of stuff can happen. Yeah, we're starting to see him do some big Hail Mary throws here. We'll see.
Senator Short, okay, worst session ever?
Well, from my standpoint, yes, and I'll tell you why. I think it has been the worst session for really accounting for the people of Washington State, the people who have made their voices heard with the passage of the initiatives that we had last year, and just really working it so people can't have a voice. And again, the best things here are the give and take. You know, that's the way it's supposed to work. That's the way it should work. Doesn't mean you get what you want all the time, but you're working hard to understand the impacts in different areas of the state. And I think, frankly, I would use the word tone deaf. And that is also a word, if I used on the Senate floor, I would get gaveled for. But it really, to me, represents session. Now, look, we did have some wins. I was proud to be one of the leaders killing the wood stove bill that would have caused double regulation in the state of Washington on really important sources of heat for Washingtonians. And I was also proud of a bill to advance you know, compensation for deer and elk damage, one that would recognize and set aside funding for our smallest counties, our Frontier One counties. And that was actually brought by constituents in Okanagan County. So I'm happy that that bill is advancing to the governor's desk, and we'll see what he does. But just know that, you know, our job is to advance the things that you care about, the things that concern you, and to really try to use these positions to be effective on your behalf.
And we'll have an update on all of this. It'll be a very exciting show next week when we wrap this all up. And we do invite you to be back here with us at 8 o'clock next Monday for Live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm Trace Yellis. Have a great day.